From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment, the home edition. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest is an actor, a producer, a director, a screenwriter, someone who has seen Clockwork Orange a few times at the age of 7 unsupervised and is now the author of the book Run Towards the Danger. I am talking to, of course, our old friend Sarah Pauley. It's good to have you back, Sarah. How are you?
It's nice to talk to you again. It's been a long time, and I really like the introduction of me. So it is a pivotal thing about someone that they watch Clockwork Orange a few times when they were 7 unsupervised.
I think there are so many things about this book that are pivotal, and I think what's fascinating to me about it and reading it, and I guess it's kind of a collection of essays that you found a way to knit together, but all of these various sections of the book, they're all about recovery, be it from scoliosis or childbirth or celebrity. They're all about recovering from something. And I just wonder if that's something you had in mind as a thematic link for this.
I'm really glad you framed it that way, because I feel like on the surface, this can seem like a book about trauma, but it is a book about recovery. I don't think that I knew that that's what I was doing when I was writing these essays. I wrote some of them over 20 years. I wrote some of them quite quickly. I didn't know what brought them together until they were kind of done. And I realized by the end of it that, yeah, it wasn't so much about the content of these traumatic experiences as it was about the process of them funneling their way through the present and moving in a different direction, and my relationship with those memories changing in a way that was a kind of recovery.
It's funny because I guess I link it to your last time here. You came up here with your terrific documentary Stories We Tell about your ability to turn a kind of a reportorial eye towards your own life, which has always fascinated me about you.
I mean, it's funny because I think I used to feel a bit self-conscious about that all my ideas seem to have some root in my life. And then I just had this moment where I went, that's okay. Like, if that's what you leave here, that's okay. I mean, it's the thing you know the most about is your own experience and how you've processed it. And I think I made some kind of peace with that my imagination wasn't consumed with fictional things as much as it was trying to sort out my own experience here on planet Earth.
Well, so much of what you are as a person, from the little I know about you, and it's often find a way to knit itself into the pieces that you created, is about characters or your own self trying to find a way to be honest with yourself in a world where people, especially in this book, is people with folks who can't quite see what the truth is or are uninterested in doing that.
Yeah, and I mean, I think the tricky thing is there's layers of honesty, right? I mean, I think you unpack one layer to find a truth, and then under that, there's another trapdoor with another truth hidden underneath. And so I think I'm just really curious about those layers, about what we think we know about ourselves, and then the way in which we find out the meaning of that thing is actually something entirely different. I think that's a lifelong process.
Well, I think it can be if you're honest about your approach to art. And I think you as an artist exist as somebody who's wants these questions answered. And so often we see, and I'm sure you've known quite a few people like this, who can be completely invested in the work, and then once the work is done, kind of turn away from any kind of examination of the human character.
It's true. I have met people who are incredibly incisive and perceptive in their work about humans, but actually totally uninterested in the ones in front of them. It's always an amazing thing to run into.
And again, almost any of these pieces could have been an entire book. You know, you're writing about your pregnancies or about growing up under these unusual circumstances, which include both touching on celebrity and losing a parent. Or the section I wanted to get into for a little bit, talking about artists who have a disconnect from their effect, your whole section on Baron Munchausen and working with Terry Gilliam and starting with what that presence of Monty Python meant in your life with your family, and how it was kind of this experience that brought everybody together. I mean, in fact, that's something that happens too often in the book, is that you start with something that brings people together and then you step back from it and see, you know, what the repercussion of the impact is.
Yeah, in regards to that essay in particular, I mean, I grew up in a house where, you know, we were obsessed with Monty Python. We'd listened to Flying Circus a million times. We'd seen their films a million times. And then, you know, suddenly at the age of 8, I was cast in this movie directed by Terry Gilliam and with Eric Idle. And the collective blood pressure in my childhood home went through the roof. Like, it was the realization of this enormous dream that no one had ever even dared to dream. And so it's not a good starting point, I would say, to go into a film production with your 8-year-old child if you're in that in awe and that starstruck by the film's director. And, you know, this was a time that thankfully there's a bit more awareness of, although it's certainly not gone by any stretch, where this concept of genius and what genius looked like was madness and craziness and an inability to see the impact of your behavior on other people. And usually it took the form of a white man. And that allowed for a lot of permission and space for things to go really awry and for things to not be responsible, for things to be reckless. And certainly I was very, very frightened for much of my time on that set. And things really did go off the rails more than once in really, really scary ways that were dangerous. So sort of unpacking that experience and how it came to pass, which I think had a lot to do with just culturally this notion of what brilliance looked like. You know, it just paved the way for so many abuses, I think. And so many, in the case that I had with Bear Munchausen, just so many things happening that were terrifying and hard on other people and traumatic for other people because we were all in the service of this genius. Now, I don't think Terry Gilliam's a monster, and I don't think he's a villain, and it doesn't serve me to think of him that way. I think he also had some beautiful qualities and he's a brilliant artist, but we didn't really hold people accountable the way we should have for the ways in which they were not being responsible with other people. And I would include him in that category of people for sure.
Now, we were talking before we started. He's someone of such enormous sort of confidence and kind of a playful charisma, because there's nothing kind of baleful or malicious about him. You can get lost in moments with him. And I can imagine, especially as a child, you know, wanting to find somebody to believe. And when you write about the absence of authority in your own household, just maybe clinging to this ideal authority figure who is also someone you idolized.
Well, he was like having like the best playmate in the world, right? Like he was like crazy. He didn't care about getting in trouble. He was so funny and he had really expensive big toys. Like who doesn't want to follow that kid around? You know what I mean? Like he's making this giant movie and like creating the most amazing playground. And he was infectious. Like his enthusiasm and his vision is infectious. And that can be kind of blinding. In my case, for decades, I think that I held my parents more responsible than I held him. And to a certain extent, yeah, like, should they have pulled me off that set a bunch of times? Absolutely. Is it really hard to stand up to 200 people on a film set where there's a lot of money and time pressure and be the one who's like not working on the set to go, sorry, I'm shutting you down because like I'm worried my 8-year-old or 9-year-old's uncomfortable or unsafe right now? Yeah, that's a big ask, I think. And I think the truth is, if you create a professional environment as a producer or director and there are kids involved, their well-being has to become your first priority beyond your film. And I think most filmmakers and producers, no matter how ethical and great they are, would be incapable of making that happen in the moment of a high-pressure moment on a film set. So in a way, many times in this book, I just question the whole notion of it. Like, can this work? I don't know.
It's the treat when we're talking to the author of the new book, Run Towards the Danger, of course, actor, director, producer Sarah Pauley. But you do write in the book about someone who is the 180 of all that, your experience with the director of Mr. Nobody and how psychological and physical safety was the most important thing to him.
Yeah. Jaco van der Mel, who's, you know, one of the more brilliant, visionary and compassionate people I've ever come across. And this was a really healing experience for me because there is a special effect in the film that I did with him. And this is in my late 20s that actually was subjectively not that unsafe. I had a big reaction to it just because my experiences with explosions and fire and special effects as a kid had been so scary and things had gotten really out of control and dangerous, you know, that I was very, very nervous. And he kind of spotted this and came over and said, you don't have to do this. And I was like, well, clearly it's safe. I just saw you test it out sitting in the place I'm going to sit in and it's fine. This is ridiculous. And he just looked at me and said, yeah, but I didn't do the Adventures of Bear Munchausen when I was 8 or 9. So we're not doing this. Like, and he just sort of walked me away from the set. And I do think it's possible to notice people's well-being on a film set, but it's very hard and it takes a lot of focus. And I can say as a filmmaker, very, very difficult to remember in those pressurized moments that the safety and well-being of the people you're working with must come first. It's very, very difficult. And it takes an extraordinary person to walk away from a shot that's taken a long time to set up just because someone's feeling not comfortable with it.
No, I just find that kind of fascinating because, you know, so much of what you're writing about in the book is kind of the difference between childhood and adulthood. That seemed like a very grown-up thing to do. You know, even talking about your family and, you know, the way your brother still makes fun of you for saying, I'm sweating, because your reaction to playing tennis when you were a kid. I just found myself really struck by that. Again, and I think so much of this is about you being such an observer, and this is something I've noted, even mentioned to you before and made you blush. I can always see you paying attention to things, and your ability to sort of note the difference between childlike behavior and adult behavior seemed to hit you at a pretty early age.
It's funny. I was noticing this summer because I made a film this summer, and I haven't directed a film in 10 years. I've been off with kids and, you know, not in this environment that I was basically raised in. So it's the longest I've ever really been away from home. And I was walking around this environment of this film set, really noticing how I was taking things in and how I was negotiating moment to moment. And what I realized is I had to figure out as a kid really quickly who I could trust and who I couldn't, and how to get people to like me, because sometimes my life felt like it was at risk and I needed those people to be connected to. And I was just sort of noticing this crazy instinct I had to connect so deeply with everybody, which it comes from a genuine place. I mean, I do like to get to know people, but I also realized there's a quality of urgency in it that must be from being in environments that felt very unsafe as a child and going, I'm really vulnerable right now. I need to figure out who everybody is, what my relationship is to them, and if they're going to be the ones to like yank me out of a shot if it gets really scary.
It's so funny because I think about the films that you've done as a director, you know, with Away From Her or Take This Waltz, and there's stories about emotional chaos and inside of a family. And I just wonder that you're trying to find some way in these films to sort of tell these stories in the ways that they hadn't been told before.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm deeply interested in the small nuances and shifts of, you know, human dynamics and emotions and the way we're grappling. I think specifically with memory seems to be a bit of an obsession. And it's strange. Like, I kind of think if you're starting to make work that's dealing with the same material over and over again, which I clearly am in certain ways, there's something about that that you don't actually have words for yet. Like, there's something in your subconscious that's pulling at a thread that you're following. And I think I can come up with a whole bunch of reasons like why these things are interesting to me. And certainly the idea of chaos. I mean, I grew up in chaos in so many ways, both on sets and after my mom died and, you know, my dad kind of fell apart. And there was a chaos there for sure. But my gut is if there's something I'm exploring over and over, it's because, you know, I don't actually know the reason why it's something, you know, it's something unresolved, ultimately, I think.
You're attracted as a person to looking for answers. And your films have all been about, in some way or another, somebody being forced to ask a question they would never thought they'd have to ask before.
In these essays, there's that desire as well. And I think that what I'm learning more as I get older is that the answers change. And the answers need to make room for other answers to sit beside them. And that if any we're looking at anything really important in our lives or in our past, it has to be, you know, an expansive process of making room for being wrong the first time and for finding a different truth that contradicts the first truth or one that can coexist beside it, but that it's this very fluid, ever-evolving process of discovery, and that the answers are really good placeholders and they feel really satisfying to find in the moment when you're looking at something difficult or hard to look at, but they're going to get replaced and they're going to get expanded upon. And I think that's sometimes where life can get boring, when you're sort of like, okay, I've found my rigid narrative of what that means and what that story was and its place in my life, and it's there and it's not moving. And I think that's where we can get stuck, or at least I can.
Well, we're going to take a break and give you a chance to get unstuck. My guest is Sarah Pauley, whose book is Run Towards the Danger, Confrontations with a Body of Memory. It's the treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. I'm talking my own insecurities with my guest, Sarah Pauly, whose book is Run Towards the Danger, Confrontation with the Body of Memory, and your movies, Stories We Tell and Take This Waltz and Away From Her, all about, I don't want to say Rashomon because I don't want to be reductive about it, but about everybody having a different answer to these kind of calamitous questions. And even Alias Grace is about that, too.
I hadn't thought of it that way before, but you're absolutely right. I think that I'm interested in stories told by a chorus of voices, you know, like that there's no one truth, that, you know, you can hear the same story. I mean, I certainly had this experience making my documentary Stories We Tell, where you hear the same story in the same family told by five different people, and you're listening to five totally different family histories. And I'm sort of mesmerized by that. I'm mesmerized by why we remember things differently from each other, how we create a context around a story that, you know, applies to our life and doesn't work for somebody else's. I think it's been really hard because of my obsession with understanding other people's versions. It's been really hard for me to know what my own versions of my stories are. I think that's what this book is sort of unpacking, is like, you know, in Stories We Tell, as an example, you know, I interview everybody in my family about something that happened to me of, you know, finding my biological father. And the only voice that's really missing is mine. I mean, I never tell my version in that story. That film is everyone else's version of a story that I lived. So the challenge with this book was like, what are my versions of my own stories? And can I let them exist? And how complex are they? And how many contradictions do they have in them? And that was like a really interesting and very challenging process for me.
In the middle of an anecdote, you stopped to interrupt yourself to say, like, you're talking about your childhood and child actors, and evidently, I have to take a moment to sort of say, I feel bad for all the people I've met who are my age, who met me when I was a kid, and I was grumpy towards them. I mean, there's a reevaluation of yourself as you're telling the anecdote, even.
There's endless ways to perceive an event, and I'm really curious in making room for all those things. Like, I don't love the settling it on a narrative. Like, I just find it less interesting. Like, I'm even developing an aversion to people telling me what they're like, you know, like when people are like, I'm this kind of person and I'm optimistic and I'm practical, or I'm all like, what about tomorrow? What are you gonna be like? How do you know? Like, how do you, and like, isn't it limiting somehow? Like, I know we're all supposed to get to know ourselves, but I'm also like deeply curious about the idea of what if we accepted that we didn't, and that we might shift radically in the next 3 weeks? Like, what if this idea of a self is like actually making our lives more boring? Because I know I've changed a lot, you know, over the years, and I don't think you could attach certain characteristics to me now that would have applied 10 years ago. But I think not having too strong a sense of self is not necessarily the sort of problem a lot of people would think it was. I think it can be really liberating.
There's a part of you that's so rebellious that the idea of holding on to a kind of simplified, boiled down narrative, and B, the idea of accepting what this sort of institutional behavior towards people in your line of work, there's a part of you that reject that so vociferously. A great part of that, and I hesitate to use this word, fun in reading Run Towards the Danger is your wrestling with these things and weighing your own kind of shifting opinions about them.
Yeah. And it's funny, as you were talking, I was thinking, I think one of the hardest things to sort of negotiate when you're thinking about what is just and what is fair and what you're going to do about it is to want to live a life where you're embracing the nuance of things and not actually vilifying people and actually like embracing the whole spectrum of human behavior and analyzing your own role in things. Like, sometimes those things can feel at odds with each other. And it's also necessary to take action sometimes. Like, it's also necessary to push back and to say, this isn't good enough and this needs to be changed, both like on an individual level and a systemic level. And so I think that that movement of like that part of you that embraces nuance and sees it, that movement of that part of yourself to the backseat for those moments where action needs to be taken can be really tricky, but also necessary. And then knowing when they can sit beside each other, you know, like I'm finding that a kind of interesting process of figuring things out as well.
Conceptually, that there's more than one answer to anything just sort of occurred to me. Just thinking about that section in the book when you and your family are going up to Prince Edward Island and the customs agent just says, it's the birthplace of Canada. And suddenly it becomes this whole thing about trying to explain it to your daughter and you try and then your husband tries and then it's still basically a free ball. That it's so much a nutshell idea of what the book is.
Yeah. I mean, because again, that answer changed for me, right? When I was younger, my kid's question to me in that moment was Canada being born a good thing? And I had been raised to think it was. And, you know, a lot of that had to do with carving out an identity separate from the United States, a trade route that went east-west instead of north-south. Like there were many things that seemed really good to me about that. And then as you, you know, learn more, and certainly this country has had a much more mainstream reckoning recently with the history of residential schools. But realizing really over the last, you know, 10 or 15 years that this country was built on genocide. It's a big moment, right? When you're sort of connected in some way to a national identity and then learn enough about it to realize that there's something horrific and violent and, you know, a people was, you know, almost decimated by the existence of this country. That's a really big thing to absorb. And so to want to give your kid an honest answer and also give you a sense of the history of your own thinking around it and also respect that they're at the time, I think 6 or 7 years old and like, you know, what gets said in that moment and how. And I think that's what's most challenging and also interesting about being a parent is figuring out how you answer these kinds of complex questions in a way that is interesting and rich and invites conversation, and can you have that conversation without panic or fear, and to know that you're not going to get it right the first time and can come back to it over and over again. I mean, it's such a privilege to get to have these conversations with my kids, but it's also the responsibility of it is enormous.
I did want to say something to you that it really struck me, and especially after seeing rewatching Stories We Tell after reading the books, I just ran to it for some reason, which is this idea that home can be such a different place for everybody. I mean, it's really, and you just said it in Stories We Tell, that house and what happened there is a different place for five people. And those homes that the incidents of the drama takes place in and take this waltz and away from her are about that too. And so often, even in the book, the idea of what home is seems to be this really fungible thing. And I just wonder when you became aware of that as a way to sort of tell stories about people.
I mean, I think my mom was somebody who changed her mind a lot. And I was really aware of that. And she made that really, she articulated that. I mean, I thought that was the most common quality in the world. And then I realized not many people do that. Not many people say, when you say, do you believe in God? I don't know. Some days I do, some days I don't. And I sort of do when I'm with my mom and I don't really when I'm with your dad. And when I'm on my own, I go back and forth. And like, you know, just the openness about not knowing and the ability to be vulnerable and not behave entirely confidently, I think was really, I found it interesting to watch somebody live that way. I think it brought her a lot of joy. And I think she lived in a state of curiosity. And so I wonder sometimes if that sort of impacted the way I kind of want to tell stories in the sense of like, I don't want to know exactly what that story is. I don't want to be too confident about it. I want to have questions and be skeptical and hear different points of view. That's possibly what it is. Yeah.
No, because I just find myself thinking about that. I mean, home being this institution, and there's a big part of you that lives to question the idea and ideals of institutional behavior anyway, but just that home is this place that has so many different kinds of meanings, and they can all be kind of violently snatched away from us. I mean, I was thinking about that in the section you're writing about finding you about your scoliosis, and you kind of bookend that with the last section, Run Towards the Danger, when you have when you're concussed, and that idea of what you thought was being a kind of a norm being snatched away from you, and then having to go back to your home and live with a norm being taken away, and what that does with your relationship to this place that we all have. We're all told there's a place that we're the safest, and these are no longer safe places for you.
Yeah, certainly as a kid, you know, I did feel that a lot. Like there would be a kind of a safe place for a minute, and then it was gone. And certainly, you know, my relationship with my body, like the subtitle of the book is Confrontations with a Body of Memory. And certainly, you know, my body has been this unpredictable thing for me. Like I've had a lot of health issues. They've come up out of nowhere. You know, it started, you know, with my spine curving nonsensically to the right, you know, when I was a kid with very severe scoliosis and endometriosis and a concussion and a high-risk pregnancy. And there's been some stuff. And I think that that does allow you, though, to take very little for granted. Like, I do feel like when I'm feeling okay in my body and not in pain, I really notice it. I really appreciate it. Like, I do think these things that happen to us add to our capacity for the gratitude for what we're living in the middle of. And right now, like, I'm not in pain and I'm not sick. And that's an amazing thing that doesn't go unnoticed by me. But yeah, I'm also aware of, like you said, like things can get snatched away at every moment. So to sort of like be fully present for these moments where things are at peace and are somewhat settled. And I think part of the joy I get in those moments is knowing that they don't last forever. Like that's just not how we're built as humans. And it's good, I think, to be able to notice when it's going well.
You know, you get a chance to note that the book cover, I want to ask you about choosing that graphic, is a curvature that once we read the book, we know exactly what that represents.
Yeah, I really love when they first showed me the cover of it. I was so happy about it because I also like, I don't know, there's this crack of light, like it's a curve of that traces the curve of my spine as a kid, but it's also like there's this yellow that's in that curve. And it's like there's something about, you know, that Leonard Cohen line of like, you know, there's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. And I do feel like, I don't know, like this, these are the privileges in life or getting to survive hard things, right? Like getting to survive hard things that soften us and make us able to be in our lives in a more rich and interesting way. Like I'm sort of grateful for all of the things that happened to me that are in this book. I mean, I didn't skip there and I didn't jump there. And I went through a lot of anger and grief first. I don't think you get to like jump to gratitude. I don't think there's a shortcut, but I'm there now. I do. I mean, I think that the jumping to forgiveness and gratitude can be a bit like you have to go through the things first, or I think it becomes like a bit of a Band-Aid or something.
I can't thank you enough for doing this, Sarah. It's always good to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. My guest is actor, writer, director, producer, Clockwork Orange watcher, and the author of the book Run Towards the Danger, Sarah Pauley. Our production staff includes Katie Gilchrist. The show is edited and produced by Rebecca Mooney. To better days, everyone. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. To catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.